Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavalleri, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm very pleased to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Gordon Parch from the Faculty of Information and Communication Technology, almost always known as the Faculty of ICT. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Parch is the head of Department of Computer Science within the Faculty of ICT. His research interests primarily focus on how software can be made more reliable, safe and dependable. He has worked on this area from various perspectives, ranging from techniques to support the creation of correct software, to techniques to monitor software while it is being used, to check that it is working as expected, and he will be expanding on that during our chat. He has been involved in projects applying these techniques on various types of systems, from aerospace software used in space missions to financial transaction systems. Recently, he's been working on automated techniques to support legal contract writing and analysis. Certainly a fascinating group of subjects and quite a mix, really. Welcome to the program, Professor Parch.
Thank you.
Well, it is a wide-ranging field, so I try to find a kick-off question that will give our listeners a good idea in general of what your field is about. So I found a quotation from Think magazine, the university's research magazine, which was written by you and your colleagues. And it says, "Computer science focuses on the development of techniques that support the construction of large, reliable and efficient systems. As users, we tend to take reliability and efficiency for granted and get really irritated when even minor glitches hold us up." Could you expand a little on what it really means to embed reliability and efficiency into systems, especially, of course, the large ones?
Mm-hmm. Indeed, I think the best way to look at this is to think about what engineers do. So on an everyday basis, we use roads, we use cars, we use bridges, and we assume that they work correctly. I mean, we never think about when we're about to go on a bridge, we never worry about whether the bridge is strong enough to take our weight. And if so, you know, have they worried about the possibility of a car driving over the bridge, you know, further to one side, or if there are five cars driving across the bridge at the same time? In the engineering profession, people have been developing techniques to study mathematically the structures, for instance, bridges, such as mechanical objects, to study their reliability. So an engineer can say, okay, I've run some mathematical models which guarantee that the bridge can withstand a certain amount of weight distributed in various configurations, etc., which means that once the bridge is built, then it will work as expected, rather than try out, you know, a few bridges, you know, and test them out by driving cars across them. In the computing sector, it's relatively quite a new field, so the idea of using these engineering approaches is also quite new. Initially, most software systems that were used have been primarily used to support what people usually do, whether it's, you know, to calculate something fast, whether it's to compute some information that would otherwise not be computable at such a fine-grained level, etc. But nowadays, as time went on, sort of these computer systems are interacting with us all the time, on more safety critical situations. You're in a plane, there's an autopilot system controlling the plane, and a few years' time we'll have cars driving themselves all over the place. You're sending an email with private information which might, by mistake, because the software is written wrongly, end up at
wrong hands.
Whatever, you know, medical devices, calculating doses of for patients, etc. So software is interacting with our lives, and in some cases it's safety critical, in the sense that if something goes wrong, people can die, or it can cost a lot of money. Because of this, it's become much more important that our software systems work correctly. At the same time, our computers have become larger, which means that our systems have become larger, and as with all things in life, when they become larger, it's more difficult to manage, whether it's a small company which becomes larger, so we need stronger management structures, whether it's a bridge, which the more complex it becomes, the more it's more difficult to build and to analyze, and similarly with software. So we've got a situation where software is becoming more complex, but it is more and more important that software works correctly. So in computer science, one of the important things that we work on is that of reliability, and work on this at different levels. So there's one level of analysis which corresponds to what the engineer would do when they're studying the bridge, right? So we develop mathematical techniques with which we can actually show that the software will work correctly. For the sake of argument, you've got an autopilot system and you want to make sure that if the plane is flying at a certain speed or faster, then it will never lower its undercarriage, for instance, because it might be fatal. So on one hand, we would like techniques to be able to analyze this. On the other hand, we also possibly sometimes would require techniques to help us develop systems that are guaranteed to be correct. So you start off with what you would like the system to do, and in a semi-automatic way, we derive a system that is guaranteed to work correctly. And a third aspect is that of testing. So in the same way that an engineer, even though they've run the mathematical models, physical models, etc., would still test the bridge before, you know, it's open to the public, we also develop techniques to be able to analyze this. So that is more or less what we mean by reliability in that context.
I remember an engineer many years ago telling me, for engineers, perfection must be the norm. And I suppose that's really true, because when lives are at stake on ships or on bridges, and I think you've made a very good analogy there, which everyone will understand, that you just can't afford to get it wrong. You're talking about these methods of testing. I was reading some of the articles that you've written, and it's interesting to look at the different kinds of methods that you use for testing, and also testing before, I suppose, it goes on sale or goes into use. And then after that, there has to be, like, you have to maintain the bridge. I suppose you have to monitor the software or whatever you've produced as well.
Indeed. One of the main issues is that the complexity of even a small software application, you know, a small app that you've got on your mobile phone, exceeds in terms of complexity by far, you know, the largest bridge on Earth. So even though, you know, that app might have been built by a 16-year-old, you know, in his parents' garage or her parents' garage. So these systems are very difficult to test a priori before you actually deploy them, before you give them to the public to use. Obviously, for the safety critical situations, there are various techniques that have been developed to try to make sure as much as possible that we've tested or analyzed them thoroughly before they are actually deployed. But still, given the complexity, it's usually impossible to say, you know, 100% with 100% assurance that the system will work correctly. So what we usually do, and this is where most of my recent research has been focusing on, is that we build what are called monitors. And in a way, what these monitors do is that they look at what the system is doing in an independent fashion. So they're not part of the system per se, but they're like another system running side by side with the system. And they check that the system works correctly. So one might say, okay, but, you know, it's like duplicating the work. Yes, indeed. But in a way, we do this on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you know, you have accountants, you know, drawing up the accounts, but at the end of the year, you've got an auditor who checks that the accounts are have been, you know, drawn up correctly. In a way, the accountant is involved in the organization of the information and splitting the information into parts. So their role is more complex in a way than that of the auditor. But the auditor, since they've already got all the information tabulated out, then at a cheaper in terms of time and effort involved, and also possibly more reliably because they're not part of the system, can actually look at these accounts and go through them and say, okay, they all add up together. So in a way, this is the role of the monitors here, that it's looking at the system and saying, just in case the undercarriage of the plane starts being lowered when the plane is going at above a certain speed, I will just switch off the electric current so as to make sure that it doesn't continue going down. On the other hand, the software that's controlling the undercarriage might, you know, be implementing complex logic reasoning to decide whether or not to lower the undercarriage, which might have some flaw which would result in lowering that. On the other hand, the other system is very simple and it's just looking out for errors. So that is the advantage of building these monitors.
You've mentioned the example of the undercarriage of the plane to describe that. Could you give us a few more sort of practical examples which we would relate to?
Now, I use the undercarriage of the plane usually because it's, you know, people tend to trust or hope to trust the sort of, you know, autopilot systems when they board a plane. But you know, there are so many systems we interact with nowadays. So, for instance, if you look at financial transaction systems, every time you go online buy something from an online shop, then there is, you know, you're giving your credit card details, they're being used, they're contacting a bank, getting the money, transferring some of the money to the courier service, etc. So imagine if such a system had to have a small mistake through which an online seller would be losing a few cents per transaction, right? That would, you know, add up very quickly and would put the seller out of business very quickly. What is worse than that, in such situations, we also have, you know, potentially malicious users trying to cheat the system. So if there might be a way of getting more money out of than what you put in by cancelling an order or something because of some flaw in the reasoning, then that is also very risky. So. In terms of user information management, in terms of financial transaction management, that is another area. But there are various other areas. I mean, the idea of monitoring what the software is doing has in fact been used in two different ways. On one hand, it is from the verification perspective, verifying that the system works correctly. And this is the example of the plane I mentioned, the bridge, the financial transaction systems, etc. I mean, everyday systems in general. But there is also another way in which these monitors are sometimes used. Sometimes monitors are used to observe the system and take additional action accordingly. So it would extend the behavior of the system in an independent sort of way. So, for instance, one application we've been looking at recently is that of online games. I mean, nowadays people, you know, spend sometimes substantial amounts of money to play online games. And if you've got cheaters in the game, you end up, you know, you're spending money to buy better, whatever, weapons, to buy better equipment. And then you get this person who installs some piece of software to control their character. And all of a sudden, you know, every time they shoot, they hit. And it can be very frustrating and can drive customers away. So one of the things we've been looking at, for instance, is using these monitoring systems to monitor what the users are doing. And by building into these monitoring systems some logic to be able to guess when a user might be an automated bot, for instance, a system that's actually controlling a player, which in most cases would be against the terms and conditions of the game. Similarly, we've used these, for instance, for business intelligence. So, you know, you've got a company which has a Facebook page, and you've got other competitors who have their own Facebook page and maybe some common Facebook page amongst, you know, all the all the different businesses in the same sector, you know, large companies end up employing people to look through these pages and answer questions, you know, make sure that when a negative comment is made, they answer immediately, they try to help out. But with smaller companies, it can be cost prohibitive to do so. And even with larger companies, I mean, it quickly becomes, you know, it becomes unmanageable to do by, you know, by a single person on their own. So what, for instance, we've been also looking at is using these techniques to monitor what is going on and be able to customize how and when you want notifications being sent to you. So you might receive an SMS saying, listen, you know, someone commented on this Facebook page with a negative comment about your service, you know, so you quickly go in and answer that comment, even though you're not online, you know, 24/7. So we're also using monitoring for this type of analysis, which is more extending existing systems with additional functionality.
I was interested also in the comment in one of your articles about the betting situation, where there has to be a certain amount of fairness, which is set up within the system and has to be monitored to make sure that neither the supplier nor one of the players is actually doing something which is not proper.
Exactly. I mean, you know, an online betting system doesn't use real dice, even if it were to use real dice, right? Real dice can be loaded and one can cheat with real dice. So in the same way that, you know, if you were to go to a casino and play, you know, gamble there, then you would assume that the authorities have made sure that they don't use loaded dice. Similarly, you know, online betting companies have to guarantee, have to actually show the gaming authorities that the ways in which they produce random numbers, you know, similar to dice rolls, is fair. Fair under a number of definitions of fair. You know, it's actually quite difficult to define fairness in that sense. But you know, once the software is out there, you know, one has to make sure that it's not tampered with, etc. So the easiest way to make sure that it is still fair is to monitor its outcome and make sure that it still satisfies the properties of fairness that have been set out a priori.
We, as just users and listeners to the news, hear a lot about hacking scandals. I know that you're concerned with the efficiency of the system itself, but does this efficiency also include sort of warding off that kind of intruder, so to speak?
In fact, there are two things that we usually worry about apart from reliability. Well, there's how effective the system is and how efficient it is. So the effectiveness of the system is how well it can identify, for instance, errors, or how well it can identify malicious users in this case. The efficiency would be the overheads taken by the system. So for instance, if you're using this on a mobile app, you would not want your application to use up too much battery, for instance, because you might still prefer to have a safer system, but if then you have to recharge your mobile every 3 hours, then it's not really feasible, right? So in terms of efficiency, it's more about, you know, use of power, use of, you know, resources like memory, etc. But then efficacy comes in sort of, you know, how effective it is in actually reaching its goals. It has been used for security reasons to try to identify malicious users. We haven't done much work in this area ourselves. I mean, the only thing we've done a little bit was with a local financial transaction company, and we had looked at trying to identify fraudulent users based on their history and their ongoing behavior. But it's quite an important area, and there are a lot of techniques being developed, and monitoring is one of the approaches that has been used a lot to identify these cases.
I'm seeing the time passing, and I had a suspicion that this was going to be one of those chats that might very well overrun, but a bit of a nasty question. Why should you trust your own software?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. Initially, I started giving the analogy of the auditor and the accountant. Why would you trust the auditor? And the reason is that what the auditor is. So secondly, you've got double checking, right? So that's already a good thing. The other thing is that what the auditor is doing is, as I said earlier, is simpler than what the accountant is doing. And the accountant has to build the accounts from scratch, which requires more thought, more effort put into the system. The auditor has things already drawn out and just checks that things work correctly. If we go back to the example of the undercarriage of the plane, it's exactly the same thing, right? You might have very complex logic, checking, for instance, the orientation of the plane, checking the speed, checking the altitude to decide whether to lower the wheels. And there can be a small flaw somewhere there which might override the velocity factor. But the monitor is very simple. It just checks the speed, the velocity of the plane, and says, oi, this shouldn't be the case that we're about to lower the wheels. Let's stop them. So our software systems are relatively very small. Apart from the fact that since they're small, we can actually analyze them more thoroughly, and we can give more guarantees that they actually work correctly.
This is obviously a huge field, and we're just scratching the surface, and our time is short. But I'd like to move on to the area of human language technologies, because I read quite a bit about them, and I think it's fascinating. I really enjoy the idea that the hard-nosed scientist is having to work in this symbiotic relationship with linguists. Perhaps you could explain where computing technologies and language meet in the research that you're doing.
So, the idea of having machines that can actually talk or understand natural language goes back quite a while. Alan Turing, the founder of computer science, taught that the best way to decide, when a machine has become intelligent would be to conduct what is now called the Turing test, check whether a machine can fool a person into thinking that it's not a machine but a person speaking on the other end of the wire. So the idea of using natural language goes back a long, long time. But I've recently started doing some work in this field. Mainly, it started off with looking at legal contracts. So in a way, one can look at the what the monitors check to be contracts in themselves, right? One can say the system has a contract with the user that if I send an email to person X, then it's never sent to another person. Or that, the plane has a contract that it will not lower the... So in a way, one can see these properties as contracts, although they're not legal contracts. On the other hand, when you install a piece of software, you agree to
don't
number
we all
of,
do it very happily without reading the small print.
Exactly. So one of the things I started doing a few years ago was looking at the mathematical aspect and logic aspect of analyzing contracts. And again, it's a very rich field going back. I think Aristotle was the first person to, as with most things, to start discussing, logic to reason about contracts. And it's actually so complex that until now there is no standard logic or standard way of looking at things. It's still very much an area in which there's a lot of work still being done till today. This led to, we started developing techniques for contract semantics, for giving meanings to small contracts. But then the natural question was, we're writing our contracts in a logic notation. Obviously, lawyers do not write their contracts in logic notation. So we started asking, can we bridge the gap and go from the natural language writing of contracts and legal documents and somehow obtain a more formal, a more logical representation, which can then be used using our semantics, our tools, to be able to analyze it. So that is where the initial interest came in, sort of, trying to make these techniques, these mathematical techniques that we were developing, trying to see how they can be applied on real-life contracts.
I can imagine that the lawyers or the notaries that are not used to using this kind of system, there might have been a certain resilience to it. How have you encouraged them from the technical point of view to actually get on board?
Yes, before I actually answer that, I think it's quite interesting. Until a couple of decades ago, 2-3 decades ago, maybe, you know, especially manual workers used to worry about machines replacing them, replacing their work. And most other people, especially, you know, lawyers and engineers, other professionals, used to, you know, laugh it off. No, of course not, you know, there'll always be the need for humans. Now that machines are starting to also support professions like, you know, engineering, like law, etc., I start getting the same comments one used to hear, you know, 3 decades ago, but this time from legal professionals saying, but this won't replace me, will it? But in fact, no, it's not meant to replace the lawyers. But the approach we've taken mainly is to try to embed our techniques within the process that they usually, that legal professionals usually use. So, for instance, you know, they usually use standard word processors such as Word.
Nobody writes contracts anymore, obviously. I mean, it's all done on computer.
Exactly.
Has been for many years now.
Exactly. But rather than, you know, building our own system that they would need to learn to use from scratch and, you know, might not be as slick as an existing, you know, large system, what we've been trying to do is extend existing systems. So, for instance, right now we've got a plugin for Word, which, you know, if you start using the word processor, you won't notice anything different, except that, for instance, you can just select a clause from a contract or from a document you're writing. You can just right click on it, and amongst the options there's a new option there which appears, which is, you know, look up this term in the laws of Malta. So for instance, you know, if you go to one of the menus, there's a sub menu which says, you know, legal analysis, and one of the options under there is, you know, highlight parties involved in this contract. And, you know, all of a sudden you get highlighting and some comments in the contract which say, listen, you know, there are two parties involved here. Party one is the tenant, party two is the, and these are the clauses, for instance, in which the tenant is obliged to do something, and these are the clauses in which the person renting, the landlord, has certain obligations or prohibitions. They are prohibited from just entering the apartment without giving due notice, for instance. So in a way, this support is given in an incremental way rather than change in a radical way
the habits.
Yeah. It's exactly the same thing, except that one day you might decide to start using one of the features, and then another, and then another, and doesn't interfere with what they usually do. So,
because you value added.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our 28 minutes, and I would like to thank Professor Gordon Parch very much for coming to talk to us about his fascinating field today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.